For the week of November 3rd, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 212, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in cell phone hell, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael Giltz in cell
it's
phone
located,
hell.
It's located somewhere near New York City,
okay.
Cell phone hell.
So you're saying that somehow you're, I would imagine that you're on an iPhone.
I am.
And that you have maybe an iPhone 4.
I do.
And that you upgraded to iOS 7, the latest, greatest operating system from Apple.
I did.
And of course, it then killed your phone.
Well, I'm having problems, though I haven't seen a ton of people describing these problems. It's a weird one. I can't receive texts. I can send a text. I got a group text. But by and large, individual texts, I'm not receiving. And so everybody, I can send a text and people send a text back and then I don't see it and I don't respond. It's a nightmare.
Well, I'm having problems, not of the phone variety. I spent the week with kidney stones. So,
ouch.
Yeah, and I would recommend, by the way, Michael, you should definitely not get these.
Well, I've never had them. I have a friend who gets them regularly, but I drink a lot of water. I drink iced tea constantly since I was like five. All I do is drink constantly all day, every day. I never sit around without a drink in my hand and it's usually flavored water. And so maybe I'm just flushing out my system, but God willing, I'll never get them. They're painful, right?
They are not fun.
Do they give you painkillers or do you just go to the emergency room or do you sit at home and suffer?
They give you painkillers. I don't understand, though, why people break into pharmacies to steal these painkillers. I would break into the pharmacy to return them.
Why?
Because they kind of make you a little loopy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what people like.
I guess. I don't know.
Well, if we're going to be loopy on today's show, what will we talk about?
That's right. I guess we should get to, say, entertainment news. That's what this show is all about anyway. We kind of...
I've got a stitch in my side and my sciatica is acting up. It's like it's the medical show.
Yeah, no. It's either we're fixing your iPhone or we're fixing my kidneys. But either way, actually what we do on this show is we take all the entertainment news from the past week. We bundle it all up and try and explain it for you. On today's show, we will be wondering, why don't movies about African-Americans play well overseas? Why did the budget on the latest installment of the Hunger Games franchise skyrocket to $130 million? Why did the filmmakers working on Star Wars Episode 7 want to push its release date to 2016? And why won't Disney let them? And why do we keep asking so many questions? Things are moving so fast in the film world these days. It's becoming more and more difficult to make a film using, well, film, actually. Just ask Ken Loach, filmmaker Ken Loach. We did, and we'll tell you what he said.
Then You spoke to Ken Loach?
Well, no, but somebody did, and we're going to report what they said.
Oh, okay.
But then there's television. Good old television. So old, in fact, that emerging technologies are upending the industry's long-held business models, causing all sorts of chaos. Mostly for us, the viewers. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and this is one of those weekends where focusing on the worldwide box office really pays dividends, because the number one movie around the world is Thor, The Dark World.
Whoa, I'm sorry, Michael. We're not doing next week's box office. We're doing
Thor has opened overseas, the sequel to Thor, and the sequel to the Avengers movie. So now it's bigger than ever, of course. It grossed $109 million worldwide. It's in 36 territories, and... that's a great start for this movie. It bodes well for how it will do in North America, given the momentum that everybody has from the Avengers film. At number two around the world is Gravity, which grossed $40 million. That's barreling past $400 million at $426 million and counting. Somebody said, you know what this means? This means it's improving its Oscars chances. And I say, no. The more big success it has, the more it's disproving its Oscar chances. Wait, that doesn't make sense. Disproving is not a word. It's lowering its Oscar chances because the bigger a hit it becomes, the more they say, well, you've had your fun.
Well, yeah, and so that, unlike in music where, say, the biggest selling song of the year...
big albums and songs often win big Grammys.
Right, exactly. It's the exact opposite in the Academy Awards, where if you haven't heard of a film, more than likely, it's the best picture.
Well, that's in foreign film. Some of the best selling movies of the year will get nominations, but they don't always win. In fact, they often don't win. It happens. Gone with the Wind, Titanic, and so on, but not always. But at number three around the world is Ender's Game. And that really puts into perspective looking at the worldwide box office. Of course, it opened in North America and had an okay opening of $28 million. Not a disaster, not a great success. They have to hope for great word of mouth now. Or, of course, it's not going to turn out well. But it grossed $30 million around the world. Apparently, it opened a few days earlier in some territories because its total is $34.5 million worldwide. So there's another $4 million thrown in there. So that's the number three movie around the world. Now, we know in North America, Sperling, movies want to be number one when they open. They plan their schedule. They try to have an open space so they can have as much success as possible. Do you think we'll start to see people engineering these worldwide openings so they can say they're the number one movie in the world on the weekend when they open? Because if you're looking at the world, Ender's Game looks even weaker than it did since it opened in North America.
I think they probably will, although what will have to start happening is, the trend we started. What will have to start happening is that people will have to report the number one movie around the world and shy away from domestic box office and reporting on domestic box office and start reporting on worldwide box office as a kind of a normal trend. And once that happens, then I think people will really look at, gee, how are we going to open this movie around the world? The problem with this, of course, is that not all movies open day and date around the world. So it could mean absolutely nothing if you open and, you know, you're in 10th place in the worldwide box office.
That's why we look. That's why we always keep looking back like a Turbo as it gets closer to $300 million or 6 months down the road, a movie can open in a bunch of new territories like China and Japan. And suddenly a movie that we thought was not a success is turning into a big worldwide success. That's why you look at worldwide box office. And that's why you don't make up your mind on opening weekend, whether it's a success or failure, because worldwide box office emphasizes, hey, look, there's a lot of territories to open in. And most movies don't open in all of them all at once. Some big tentpole movies do, but a lot open up over a span of 3 months or 6 months. And therefore, you know, Ender's Game opening number three, not a disaster. It's only in six territories. It didn't open great in North America. But, you know, you have to see what the word of mouth is, what the legs are, things like that. One thing that really puzzles me about this is people say, oh, you know, Ender's Game finally ends the curse of the young adult novel franchise. They said, oh, you know, it's been a while now. All these young adult movies, you know, these books that they're trying to turn into franchises have been flopping at the box office. To which I say, no, young adult books have not been flopping at the box office. Bad movies adapted from young adult books have been flopping at the box office. Things like City of Bones and movies that nobody cared about. Like, don't blame the genre.
I don't know. I mean,
you made a couple of bad movies.
It got good reviews. The film got, you know, was...
What, Ender's Game?
Yes, from what I understand, it got
good. Well, this is the one that broke the curse. It got okay reviews. It didn't get great reviews. It got okay reviews. It's people aren't hailing it as great. No, they're not, also not saying it's a disaster, but it's mixed to decent reviews, I would say.
I didn't check the Rotten Tomatoes on that, I have to admit.
At number four around the world is Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. Another $26 million. It's at $80 million worldwide. At number five, what I believe is an Italian comedy, Sole a Catinelli. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but it grossed $18 million in one territory. Looking at the trailer, which has no English subtitles, I'm still not quite sure what the movie's about, but it's a funny, crazy guy mixing it up with rich people. That's all I can grasp about that. But that's a very strong opening for
one
territory.
And what makes you think that it's Italian? Are they eating a lot of pasta in the trailer?
The credits of the people who are listed on IMDb.
Okay.
There's no movie summary, but there is, you know, information on it.
Okay.
So Ender's Game did not do well on Rotten Tomatoes. Look at it. It's at 61%.
Oh, okay.
And top critics at 52%.
I take it all back.
But it's not a disaster, and it's a movie not geared really towards critics, if that makes sense. Every movie should be, but there you go. At number six around the world is Captain Phillips, $18 million it made, $125 million worldwide. At number seven, Last Vegas. That's the hangover for old people. It grossed $16 million, and right behind it is Free Birds, an animated film about turkeys who go back in time to try and end the tradition of eating turkeys on Thanksgiving. That grossed $16 million opening up in North America. Only cost $55 million to make, but for an animated film geared towards Thanksgiving, terrible reviews, much worse than Ender's Game, and not a terribly strong opening for a kid-friendly movie with not a lot of competition. So not a good start. I know your kids wanted to see it, Sperling. Did they force you to take you to it?
No,
did they force you to go see the movie?
They did not, and when I saw the reviews, I was very pleased that they did not. Of course, I didn't mention that, hey, by the way, you know that that movie with the billboards that say, hold on.
It's a turkey.
Yeah, it's a turkey, all right. I didn't mention that it had been released, so that might have something to do with it. Everybody I know who saw Last Vegas loved it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, so it's getting good word of mouth. And by everybody, do you mean the people at the old folks home where you volunteer every week?
No, but I live right up the street from this place called the Motion Picture Old Folks Home. This would have been funnier if I could remember the name of it.
But I know what you mean, yeah.
The whole thing, what Jeffrey Katzenberg contributes to. It's basically a nursing home for people who work in the motion picture industry. I live right up the street from it.
Well, you might want to volunteer there. If you spoke to them, they probably wouldn't love it. It got dreadful reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, 24%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Way, way down there, yeah. So I don't know who you spoke to, but maybe they're not the people you should turn to for film advice. And number 9 around the world is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. Another $15 million. It's at $176 million worldwide. And then at number 10, another animated film, Turbo. $12 million it made. It's at $270 million. Jeffrey Katzenberg was right. You know what? The day this movie opened in North America, they probably looked at their chart and knew what it would make around the world. So when he said it's going to be profitable, meaning it's going to hit about $300 million, he was right. And they've already spun off a TV show that's coming. This movie was geared to appeal to Spanish-speaking audiences with the various casting and some elements in the movie. So maybe that paid dividends in Central and South America and Spain. I don't know if that's the case, but that's a possibility. But it's not going to make them a ton of money. However, it will hit profitability.
Well, now, didn't you say you'd eat a snail if it hit
We haven't gotten to $300 million yet. And that, frankly, that seems unfair, really. To eat a snail in celebration of Turbo's success, shouldn't I adopt a snail? But yes, yes, we'll switch to video and by God, I'll eat a snail. And number 11 around the world is Stalingrad, doing very good business, holding very well in 3 weekends. $11 million, it's at $60 million and counting. That, of course, is the Russian film about the tragic, their version of the Alamo. And it was shot in 3D. It was shot in IMAX. Boy, I can't wait to see that movie.
Well, wait a second. I think if I'm not mistaken, this is a movie that opened very well in China. So this is a Russian film opening well in China.
Oh, now, is that where it went? Is that where it expanded this weekend?
I believe so. Yes. So, normally, of course, there's only 34 imported movies allowed into China every year. And in the past, they've all been Hollywood films. Here we have one from Russia.
There's always one or two from other countries, surely a French film or a...
There haven't been in the past.
Never? Not, this is the first Russian film to ever be released in China?
Oh, I'm sure it's not. But, under the quota system, this has been released now. Most of the quota films, if not all of them, have been Hollywood fare. In this
really?
Case...
France has not gotten a foot in. The Sweden's Go with the Dragon Tattoo, no chance in heck.
I'd have to double check that. I would definitely have to research that.
There you go. I'm sure it's essentially true that most movies are Hollywood. So that's a big breakthrough for them. It'd be great. And I'm sure in the future we'll see a chart or a graphic that will show these movies opening up worldwide. And we'll know what territories they've opened in, which ones they haven't, and how many territories they have to go. We'll know everything. But right now we're sort of in the dark as we forge this new path in worldwide box office. At number 12, making about $6 million, and number 13, making about $6 million, and at number 14, making just under $6 million, are three movies. One is Escape Plan with Schwarzenegger and Stallone. That's made $60 million worldwide. Number two is The Counselor, a movie which is dropping hard here in North America. All-star cast, but still not good reviews for the Ridley Scott drama. That's at $17 million. And at number 14, making $5.7 million to be specific, here's a mind blower for me. It's Adam Sandler's film, Hotel Transylvania, an animated film linked to Halloween. It grossed $5.7 million in one territory. It's grossed $354 million worldwide. Here's what I want to know. This movie came out like last year,
right?
That's
right. Last Halloween.
So somebody sat on this movie all year and then opened it up in their territory the weekend after Halloween. Like, what? Is there some Halloween-related holiday in whatever country it opened up in that takes place the weekend after our Halloween? I know Halloween's not a big deal worldwide. A lot of other countries don't celebrate it, but they waited a year and then opened it up the weekend after Halloween. What the heck?
I have
I'd
no
love
I can't
to know what the thinking was of that one. Because even if you don't pay attention to Halloween, you're probably vaguely aware that it's happening somewhere else. You get TV shows and movies and things themed to Halloween in lots of parts of the world, even if you're not celebrating yourself. So that's just bizarre as far as I'm concerned. So if anybody can figure out what territory it's released in and why, that would be great to know.
Have you seen the film, Hotel Transylvania?
I didn't. I heard it was pretty good.
It is actually pretty good.
Well, there you go.
It's basically Dracula, has a kid, and he's trying to teach the kid, he doesn't want the kid to leave the castle. And the kid wants to leave the castle, and he's trying to convince the girl not to leave the castle, and he has this big, giant Halloween party, you know, in her honor, her 18th birthday.
Well, it cost $85 million to make, which obviously does not include Adam Sandler's back end, because even though it's an animated film, he made that baby happen, and he was looking for a hit, and he got one with this movie. So I'm sure he's happy. Maybe he went to wherever territory it is to promote the opening. But so that's a very solid hit. Four times its announced budget, as far as we can tell. So the really big news, I think, this week is Ender's Game. It did open at number one in North America. It did not get great reviews, but not embarrassing reviews. The thing that puzzled me about the movie is that they said, well, we'll have to see what its legs are like to see if this could be a potential franchise. What do you think about that, Sperling? Ender's Game is a franchise.
I think they'd be lucky to get another movie out of this. Maybe one other movie, if they're lucky.
I'm guessing you have never read the other books.
Yeah, I know that the other books are not very good. That basically Ender's Game, the first book, was the book that everybody liked by Orson Scott Card. And then, of course, it like fell off a cliff when people read the other books. They went, what the heck happened here?
He wrote five or six other books. I mean, there's lots of books and short stories connected to Ender's Game. People do like it in sci-fi world. There are fans of it, just like there are fans of all the books in the Dune trilogy. But as a movie, they would be dreadful. Like, right. There's things that, you know, it's political, it's philosophical, it gets lost in its own maze. It's not remotely the commercial property that Ender's Game is. It's not a franchise at all. You could, of course, ignore the books and just make...
I was just going to say that. Why bother with the books?
But nonetheless, when you make Dune, if you think to yourself, man, we're going to have a great franchise here, you're kind of stupid. Because you haven't read Dune Messiah or Children of Dune or all the other Dune books. Eventually, actually, they started to make more commercial, more plot-driven books. But he became really, Frank Herbert, that is, became really caught up in the philosophy and ideas that he introduced in Dune and said, to heck with the plot. I'm just going to go off on my own here. Same thing with The Golden Compass. That was a would-be franchise. If that first film had been a bigger hit and they had made the two sequels to The Golden Compass, oh my God, the last movie is about the death of God. And children discovering sex in the Garden of Eden. I mean, it's completely uncommercial.
Well, so, and that's part of why New Line Cinema doesn't exist anymore.
These people read these books and go, we got a franchise. No, you don't. And if you do, you anger the people who actually like the books because they're so far afield of what the books truly are. So to me, it's just a stupid idea that that would be a franchise. It was a clever premise for a book. The short story came out in 1977. The novel version came out in 1985, and it had one good little insight. It said, hey, look, kids are really good at video games, much better than adults, just as those became popular. And war is perhaps moving more towards a video game future, which is actually true. People sit in rooms in Las Vegas and fly drone planes and drop bombs on people, just like they're playing a video game. That's not an exaggeration. So, hey, if kids are great at video games and war is becoming more like a video game, what if kids became the warriors of the future and they were the ones who shouldered the burden of learning how to fight and defending the world? So it was a very clever premise, executed well in that one book, but that's the beginning and end of it.
Right, and I would agree with that. And maybe you could take those characters and do a spinoff, but you could not follow the books. Now, I knew I was not a science fiction reader when I read Dune, the first book, and it just took me forever to get through it. And I kept thinking, I don't like this. And then I tried to read the second book. I never finished it.
No, you would. I actually like Dune a lot, but I can understand not liking the other. I read the first four books. And, you know, I just plogged through them at the end. Recent years, the son of Frank Herbert has done books with another author and extended the franchise. And they've been a little more plot driven and fun again, just like the first Dune. But essentially, I can understand why you get bored with it. But people aren't getting bored with 12 Years a Slave. That, of course, has been opened in North America and expanded nicely. It expanded to about 400 screens. It made $4.6 million this weekend in North America. It's also in two other territories. And it basically doubled its box office in one weekend. So it's expanding well, expanding nicely. 11,000 per screen shows a lot of strong interest still as the movie goes a little bit wider. So it's definitely taking the slow and steady classic platform release schedule where it tries to capitalize on good reviews and then hopefully end of the year awards.
Yeah, this is the big festival favorite, you know, basically won Toronto. Everybody loved it in Telluride, and now it's well on its way into the awards season.
But will it do well overseas? Now, the New York Times had a story about this.
Right, and here's the thing. I think that a movie about slavery is already kind of hard to sell. It depends on whether the story is good, I understand. But this is an American story. So, and
well, slavery is a worldwide phenomenon.
I understand that, but this particular story is very American. Now, I know that, you know, they talked about
It's a film about an American woman. Who would want to hear about an American woman overseas? It's like, it's a film. It's a story. People can understand the idea of slavery. Can't they be caught up in it, no matter where they're from? And, of course, there's Africa. There's whole parts of the world where black people live.
Okay. I haven't seen the film yet. I have not seen the film yet.
That's well, who cares? What's that got to do with it? We're talking about, should this movie play worldwide?
Well, without having seen the film, I would say any film that tells a good story could play worldwide. However, there is a history of films that star African-Americans or are about baseball. They don't do well overseas.
Or Westerns didn't travel well for a long time. Yeah, but I think it's the cart before the horse. There are big worldwide movie stars like Will Smith and Denzel Washington. They usually star, of course, in broad appeal movies that aren't specifically about the African-American experience. Will Smith is in, you know, Independence Day. Denzel Washington is in whatever, Training Day, a million different movies, which of course does deal with it in some small ways. But I think they don't bother to release the movies. I think it's a big mistake. I think it's a successful film. Africa, of course, is one of the last big territories that's really, really underscreened. There is a lot of black market there, a lot of, counterfeit DVDs. And very little strong multiplex presence in Africa, I assume, right?
Oh, my gosh. It's South Africa, yes. There are a lot of screens in South Africa. There are some in Egypt, Morocco, and, all of the...
But it's really hard to release a movie there because people people black market them right away. It's a really hard territory to get a good, strong commercial
release.
Well,
logistically, it's very difficult. Just from the logistics.
Well, you make it sound like they're in the tundra. I mean, there are roads in Africa.
No, I understand that, but there aren't the infrastructure of the multiplex infrastructure has not permeated there as much as it has in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's really a case of just not trying. I can't understand why Madea Films wouldn't travel to Africa and other parts of the world. I can't understand why a good movie is a good movie. The Butler, or should I say Lee Daniels, The Butler, made a lot of money in North America. Yes, it's about the American experience. It's, the last 40 years of civil rights history. But if it's an entertaining film, it should work worldwide. We got a British director, a British star. We've got a critical acclaim. There's no reason why 12 Years a Slave couldn't catch on worldwide. They just need to make the effort. Well, there's a lot more to talk about in the limited release vein, the art house circuit. Let's talk about Blue is the Warmest Color.
Oh, I love talking about this film. I mean, I did like this movie, as I mentioned numerous times on this show. Of course, I saw it in Cannes and liked it there. It went on to win the Palme d'Or. This is, as it was known in Cannes, the three-hour lesbian movie.
I don't even see it on the charts.
No, I mean, it's not necessarily raking in the dough.
No. I'm looking at the Box Office Mojo weekend chart to see how it did in limited release and territories. There are movies that are only on four screens. I don't see it listed here. Where is it?
I don't know. I can't speak for Box Office Mojo.
It's still playing in New York, though.
It is playing in New York. And the Blue is the Warmest Color. This is the French film.
Yes.
By Kashish.
And what's the news? It's rated NC-17, which makes a lot of barriers. Some places just won't show those movies. They won't let you advertise those movies. It's a big problem. So what's happening with it?
Well, last week we said that IFC, the IFC Center in New York, was going to allow teenagers under the age of 17 to go in and see this film should they wish. They weren't going to necessarily adhere to the NC-17 rating because the ratings are, after all, voluntary and voluntarily enforced. And Cinemark now, this is a big domestic theater chain and actually international theater chain. I think it's the number three in the U.S. and North America and possibly within the top five in the world. They are going to show the first NC-17 film, Blue is the Warmest Color. They're going to show it in one theater.
One theater in Illinois decided they would do it. It's not that the chain as a whole said we'll do this everywhere.
Right. It's a test in one theater. It's not a policy change.
To see if the sky falls in.
Right. Well, and I also think that it's in Evanston, Illinois. So I think
what does that mean?
The clientele there. Is there a college in Evanston, Illinois?
I don't know.
Northwestern is in Evanston, Illinois.
Well, there you go. It's a college town, so they got a more sophisticated audience who likes to go see art films, so there's more of a demand for the movie.
Precisely, and that's why I say, you're basically opening it. You have an audience there for it.
Right, and they're saying, look, but people in Evanston are saying, hey, how come you never show any art films? They got a 20-screen theater probably or 16. why not show that movie there? But they're showing it, but are they, they're not dropping the under 17 ban. They're just saying, we'll show the movie. You have to be, you know, over 17, right?
Yes, that is correct.
This is nothing to do with the age limit. This is just, they're going to show it. So they had a blanket policy. We don't ever show NC-17 movies. We're going to make an exception and see what happens.
That's right.
Well, guess what? It's not pornography. So don't worry about it. Show it and people will watch it and be fine.
And as I mentioned, I really like Blue is the Warmest Color. It won the Cannes Film Festival this past year, but it didn't win it just for the filmmaker, who was Abdellatif Kechiche, who is both, I guess, Algerian and French. It was given to the Palme d'Or, that is, was given to Kechiche, the filmmaker, as well as its two stars, Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos, who I think, you know, has a
chance.
The
actress has won the top prizes, the top acting prize as well.
Are you sure about that? I wonder, is that true?
Trying to remember. I thought you just said it.
Well, no, it's not that they won the top acting prize. They won the Palme d'Or with the filmmaker.
Oh, they brought them up to receive it.
No, they won. They were all handed it together. It wasn't that.
Whatever, I wasn't there. So what are you saying, that they claimed that those girls all toured the film? Wasn't it
yes.
just a polite thing at the ceremony? They didn't say, you are responsible for this film. I mean, they don't. What?
They did. Yes, they did. Yes.
All right.
That was part of the not necessarily controversy, but the part of the uniqueness of this past year's Palme d'Or ceremony. But that said, the reason I mention this is because those two actresses, one of whom is more known, Léa Seydoux, whereas Adèle Exarchopoulos is kind of a discovery.
This is their first name.
Yeah, Adèle. Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, in the original title of the film is La Vie d'Adèle, which is the life of Adèle. All of this said, she is kind of a newcomer, and she was kind of discovered by Kechiche.
Okay, and?
Wow, you didn't take the bait there. I thought you were going to take the bait and run with the casting stuff.
Well, I don't know that he cast her. You're making it sound that you say that you're not, you don't understand what casting involves. You say he made the film, and therefore he discovered this girl. He approved her. Obviously, he made the film. But I'm sure there's a casting credit on Blue is the Warmest Color. And maybe that casting agent found that person, brought her to his attention, and said, you need to cast this girl. Maybe she pushed for him against his wishes. So that's the whole point. Casting is a very complicated part of movie making. It's where it all begins. You don't have actors in the film, you've got no film.
Well, wouldn't you say that? Don't you think there's a screenwriter out there that would disagree with you?
That's true, too. That's true, too. That's saying that they're not important, too, but the casting of that movie was done by Sophie Blanvillain and Bahija El Amrani. Pardon me for butchering your name, but those two people have the casting credits on Blue is the Warmest Color. I don't know which one discovered Adèle, or, you know, Leia was a little bit better known. I think she's done some modeling work as well. So, you know, they were known, but they brought these... Presumably they found them and brought them to the attention of the director. I mean, that's the most important part of the film. But casting is a crucial element in movies that's wholly unappreciated. 9 times out of 10, if somebody's reviewing a movie and they say, what a great casting, they credit the director. They don't credit the casting person. They say, oh, what great person Quentin Tarantino found. Who knows if he found them? Maybe the casting director did. And that's their job. And that's why this movie has just opened up in New York. It's called Casting By. And it's about some of the great casting people in Hollywood history, like Lynn Stallmaster, and explains a little bit more about what they do. And some people are hoping that if this movie is a success and can bring attention to casting and highlight and explain to the general public exactly what casting agents do, maybe that will create a little momentum that casting agents can finally get their own Oscar category.
Well, okay, so that's why we're really talking about this, is because Woody Allen wrote this kind of open letter, quote-unquote.
Let's not exaggerate. The Hollywood Reporter made it sound like Woody Allen in an unprecedented letter to Hollywood. It's like, it looks like he released a statement to them.
Yes,
paragraph statement. It's fine. It's nice. He talks about his great casting agent, Julia Taylor, but the Hollywood Reporter overhyped it to the ninth degree. But anyway, what did he say in it? Give one of his quotes. It's very charming.
Well, he said that my history shows that my films are full of wonderful performances by actors and actresses I had never heard of and were not only introduced to me by my casting director, Juliet Taylor, but in any number of cases pushed on me against my own resistance. And he goes on to say how he was unfamiliar with these people, including Meryl Streep for a small part in Manhattan. When she was a relative unknown, by the way.
But Jeff Daniels, Mary Beth Hurt, Patricia Clarkson, Mario Hemingway, Diane Wiest, all these people, he says, I had no idea who they were, and Julia Taylor got them and forced me to use them in a lot of cases.
And he says, I'm particularly difficult in the casting because the whole process bores me and embarrasses me. If it were up to me, we would use the same half dozen people in all my pictures, whether they fit or not.
Very good. That's very good. Right. So that's a nice little statement that he released talking about he owes a big part of the success of his movies to the casting process, which he would never do if he had his druthers. But Julia Taylor makes him do it. And she's great and has done a great job.
Do you know
and
how so many times I've heard Woody Allen say, I don't really like being on the set or the film yeah. stuff or like the whole movie business or any of it. Or why do I make movies? I should get another job. You know, why does he make movies? He doesn't like casting. He doesn't like shooting. He doesn't like being out in the cold to shoot the movies. He doesn't like the writing process is so hard. What the hell? Why is he making movies?
I don't know. All I know is that Casting By, which opened up in New York, only made just under $8,000 on two screens. So it made about $4,000 per screen. Not a great start for the movie. Not probably going to be a steamrolling success.
An inside baseball documentary.
It is, but an entertaining, well-made film can appeal to a wider audience. I didn't say it was going to make $20 million, but $4,000 per screen is not great.
Let me rewrite this in the vein of, say, The Hollywood Reporter or Variety. It is the highest grossing documentary ever made about the casting process.
Fair enough. Let's remember, where are we? What's the detail? It's that casting is the only single card opening credit that is not recognized by the Academy Awards with an Oscar. Single card, meaning I guess that when it flashes on the screen, no other credits are there at the same time.
That's right.
So Casting By, there it is. It's the last one that hasn't been recognized.
What about associate producer or executive producer? Those have not been recognized. We need an executive producer.
Producers do get it.
I know.
Right. So, all right. It's the last one that doesn't. And every category had to be added at some point, like makeup. I was just reading up on The Wizard of Oz and found that when that movie came out, it started a groundswell of effort by people saying, hey, how come makeup doesn't have its own award? Look how important it is to this movie. My God, anyone can see it was essential to the success of the film. She's got green skin. It should have an award. And eventually they change awards and they add them all the time.
You know what I say? That's not good makeup. That's just bad lighting.
Recently they added Best Animated Film. That was a big change. And of course, they fiddle with the Best Picture category. They expanded it to 10, and now we have the variable pricing thing where it can go from 5 to 10 people being nominated for Best Picture based on the voting.
You mean 5 to 10 films being nominated, but yes.
That's right. So could Best Casting be added to the Oscars as a category?
Yes, but it's difficult, and partly because...
Well, it's taken 100 years, and it hasn't happened. Of course it's difficult.
Well, I don't mean it's difficult to add it. I mean it's difficult because unlike a craft where if you light it well and shoot it well, hey, these are things that... You can see the end result on
the film. You can see the end result because you see the actors in the movie.
Right. However, it's more dependent upon things such as contracts and whether the person is available.
Same thing with cinematographers. Same thing with production. What are you talking about? They all have contracts. They all have to agree to be in the movie. What are you talking about? Casting is casting. It's just as valid as any other tech part of making a movie. How is somehow casting more nebulous than cinematography?
Well, because it's more contractually contract-based than it is. It's more contract-based and business-based.
We're not talking about George Clooney. We're talking about...
What is the craft? Let me ask you this.
Casting comes before by getting the director to see people they hadn't thought about, to get into the cast against the type they had in their head, getting them to recognize unknown people, putting the right people together, bringing together the right range so that the director can find the right people for the roles. You're going to say, yeah, but I mean, what if they couldn't get them? Because, well, if it doesn't work out, you end up with a bad movie. The script could not work right, and you end up with a bad... Lots of elements go into making a good movie, but casting is just as valuable. You watch the movie, you say, wow, what a bunch of great actors in The Big Chill. What great casting that was.
Yes.
So what do you mean?
But that's a...
You say, yeah, but they have to have contracts. Well, of course they do.
No, so I'm saying this is more of a... It's not a craft. It's that where's the craft in making a phone call to an agent?
Seeing an artist on stage and going, that is a really talented actor. I'm going to remember them. I'm going to push for them. That Meryl Streep can act her ass off. And then when you get up to a movie, you say, you need to put this woman in that role. I say, I don't know. I never heard of her. Put her in the role. You need to cast her in this role. You cast her in the role. You make their career. And that's why you have this movie where you see actor after actor extolling the casting agents who made their careers by championing them, by putting them in roles, by supporting them, by giving them the support that they needed and the emotional validation, even though they weren't eating well and were struggling with other jobs to try and keep going with their acting career. Casting agents are an incredibly important part of the career. Of course it's a tech.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Now, of course, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but if you go with casting director, why not agenting? Best agent, best manager.
On a film? Films don't have managers. Films don't have agents. Films, however, do have casting directors because they've got the credit at the beginning of the movie.
Okay, so let's take your line of reason. Where is best craft services and best catering and best
they're
negative cutter?
They're not at the beginning of the movie. They're not at the beginning of the movie. They're in the end, at the end credits. They haven't established themselves enough to deserve to be seen as important enough to the movie. And we could obviously argue why craft services probably doesn't deserve to be in the award. You get the best craft services in the world, it won't make the movie 1 ounce better. It makes the people happier. They might work better. But nonetheless, if they're that great, they work their way up to get to the beginning of the movie before the movie begins, get their single credit space where they're the only one listed on screen. Hasn't happened yet. More power to them. Composer, however, does in fact have a credit at the beginning of the movie.
Script supervisor.
Well, at least they have something to do with the movie, unlike manager and agent, your asinine earlier comparisons. There's no manager for a movie. There's no way you're saying, well, golly, if we let casting director, we'll have to let everybody get an Oscar. Is that your argument now?
So let me ask you this. When Nick Wexler gets a credit on a movie because he's the manager of the star.
He doesn't get a credit that qualifies him for an Oscar. He doesn't get his name up there alone saying Nick Wexler. And he's not involved in the making of the movie.
That is not true.
Well, he's not. What?
That is
if
not true.
If he gets the credit as a producer on a film and he's qualified for the Best Picture Oscar, he gets his Oscar. I don't give a damn how he did it.
Wow. Try, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, might I suggest never playing devil's advocate opposite Michael Giltz?
Why are you saying such dumb things? Well, I mean, that's it. What's your concern? Do you really not think there should be an Oscar for casting? Do you really think that they don't do anything and that it's just vague? You know, well, you know, it depends on their agents and contracts. It doesn't, blah, blah, blah.
Not playing devil's advocate. The difference between what a casting director does and say what a producer does, because they're both. Wait, let me finish.
But I don't say producer because half of them don't deserve it. And that's why they had to limit the things all these years.
Let me finish. Both are bringing things together. Unlike, say, a cinematographer who's looking through a lens whose work you can see, his or her work you can see.
The casting director? They're actors in the film. How can you not? Can you not see them? Are you blind?
Right, but you don't see what went into putting that actor there.
You and most people have no idea what went into putting the production design together or the cinematography.
So what I'm saying is if you're giving a producer an award or recognizing a producer for their work, which is, again, a lot of it is contractual, some of it is creative, a lot of it is putting people together and putting resources together, which is what a casting director is doing, is putting actors together and putting talent together for filmmakers to select from and pushing for certain things, as you mentioned, and trying to champion certain actors over others, then in that case, yes, if you're giving the producer an award for doing the same type of work, then yes, I guess you could say casting director would fit into that.
Well, gosh, I'm sure they'll be so grateful for your begrudging acknowledgement. Say, is there a concern that if casting award gets added, that it will just go to the best picture? If you're the best picture, you must have the best casting.
No, I don't think so. Right. I don't think so. I think really what they're concerned with is, oh my God, this award show is already 3 hours long.
Well, they don't show every award on camera. So if they
add 25 awards or 24 awards, something like that, they have been showing them all on camera.
Remember this year they didn't? They did a thing where they, you know, they paired two together or whatever. You know, there's no rule that says it has to be on camera.
You know, I've been trying to forget this past year's Academy Awards.
Right. Well, Argo won Best Picture.
Yeah,
but would it have won Best Casting? It might have.
Yes,
it might
actually
have won Best Casting, but it would have competed against Django Unchained, Silver Linings Playbook, and Beasts of the Southern Wild, which discovered a lot of unknown people and that young little actress who got nominated for Best Actress. So if there was an upset there, it might have been Beasts of the Southern Wild. More specifically, I'd say this year, if Gravity won Best Picture, it almost certainly would not win Best Casting. There's only two people in it, and they're big movie stars. So, again, you would say that would, if that won Best Picture, chances are that some other movie would win Best Casting, I would think.
And wasn't somebody else supposed to play Sandra Bullock's role?
Right. It's true that it would probably go more strongly to large ensembles. You know, that's just a given. Gravity, having only two people in it, the casting is still important and their chemistry is important. Just like Amour, that French film, there's two or three actors who dominate the film. So you think, well, there's not a lot of casting there. Yes, but they're great, well-known actors, but they had marvelous chemistry and worked well together. So it's true that large ensembles would be favored over smaller movies in the casting category, I assume. But, you know, like the King's Speech won the Oscar in 2010. If the other movies that were up for Best Picture were up for Best Casting, you'd be looking at The Kids Are All Right, which was a really, you know, well-cast movie. Winter's Bone, which put Jennifer Lawrence on the map. The Fighter, Inception, The Social Network, True Grit. You know, it's possible King's Speech, you know, as big pictures do, they often win multiple awards. But I think casting would, you know, not be lockstep in with Best Picture. I think we've got a couple examples already. And I think it would be a really important acknowledgement of something that they've been doing for 100 years.
Angelina Jolie was originally cast to play the Sandra Bullock role.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Well, Jennifer Lawrence, of course, came to prominence in Winter's Bone. That was where a lot of people first recognized her.
That's where I first mentioned her on this very show, saying, this is a star. And of course, now she's an Academy Award winner.
And she's starring in the sequel to The Hunger Games.
That's
called,
right,
Catching Fire, which is coming out soon.
Ooh, I like your transitions.
That's right. And we had a little piece about the budget of the movies.
That's right. I guess everybody's shocked and amazed that the budget exploded to $130 million.
Well, nobody's shocked and amazed. That isn't the story. They just detailed why it happened. Nobody's stunned that a sequel to a really successful movie costs more to make, are they?
I hope not.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, let's not hype it up as if, like, everyone has, oh my God.
Wait, isn't our job to hype up?
No, our job is to puncture the hype.
Okay, well, I know that Jennifer Lawrence, she made a whopping $500,000 for the first film, which, given where she was in her career, not bad, actually.
But, plus box office bonuses.
Yeah, of course, right, because those are kind of like, you know, almost mandated by the union. But then the second film, she got a little bit of a bump to $10
million. So again, I say, how come, oh my gosh, I've forgotten his name, Charlie Hunnam from Sons of Anarchy was only offered $100,000 due to the first movie in 50 Shades of Grey? That seems an incredibly low amount for a movie from such a huge property. 50 or 100 million copies of the book sold, planned trilogy of films. I still think 100,000 is insanely low.
It was 125,000, first of all.
That's insanely low. That's bizarre to me. People get more than that per episode on a TV show.
Did we ever mention who was cast in that film? I can't even remember who it was now.
It's an unknown actor, you know.
I guess somebody knew him.
So The Hunger Games cost $78 million.
You know who knew him? A casting director knew him. That's who.
That's right. The Hunger Games cost $78 million to make, which was very low for a launch of a franchise. And in fact, I think it showed a little bit in some of the cheesier special effects. It made almost $700 million worldwide. So it's no surprise that The Hunger Games Catching Fire, its budget has gone up to $130 million, which probably reflects a bigger canvas for the movie, more action set pieces, and the fact that they had really nickel and dimed the actors in the first film.
Jamie Dornan is who was cast in 50
Shades. Well, good for him. So the male stars in the movie also got bumps up, of course, in salary. They're not as much as Jennifer Lawrence. So you're looking at about a $30 million, you know, in budget increase. $30 million of that, it went up almost $50 million, just over $50 million. About $20 million of that, $25 million is salaries.
So let's look at which they wouldn't
have paid out anyway. And another $25 million is actual additions to the budget.
Well, then let's look at The Lone Ranger. Everybody said, well, why did that movie cost $225 million to make? Yes, some of it is on screen. But I would say a lot of it is on screen when you start to look at Gore Verbinski's rate and you start to look at Johnny Depp's rate. Those people are making big bank.
But they're probably not even as included in the
original.
Although
I would say big, big salary, since bank would mean they were actually earning their keep, which in that case they did not.
Right, but I mean, in that case, their salaries probably, and what the money they were going to make probably wasn't included in the budget.
Oh, I'm sure
very,
it was.
Very little of it.
No, it absolutely was. They all claimed to have taken pay cuts to bring the budget down from $250 to $225 million.
Right, but, you know, Johnny Depp, if it had clicked, if it had made $1 billion like Pirates, was going to make another $50 million. It certainly wasn't $50 million of the budget.
No, because of course there's
some bet. Whatever 10 or 20 or 10 or 12 million they counted was nowhere near what they hoped or expected to make if the movie clicked.
That's right. Of course, that was a Disney film. And speaking of Disney, Bob Iger, who runs Disney, he pretty much has his plans. He had his plans for, of course, The Lone Ranger there. It didn't work out too well. And he has plans for his product roadmap, as they say in the product management business. And that
the hell are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about like
he's got upcoming movies coming up. He's making the Star Wars movies.
Right. Well, he's not, but J.J. Abrams is. And Kathleen Kennedy is.
And is Iger in charge or Alan Horn?
Bob Iger is ultimately in charge. Alan Horn, of course, is the chairman of the, you know, Walt Disney Studios, but Bob Iger is the CEO of Disney. So he's ultimately in charge. And he's saying, hey, I need that film, this Star Wars Episode 7. I need that in 2015. So don't be asking me to push the date back to 2016 just because you don't have something called a script.
So this is what's going on. The people behind the movie said, hey, we want to push the movie back. And he said, absolutely not.
Pretty much. Kathleen Kennedy said, you know, funny thing, we just lost our screenwriter who had been working on the film for 12 months. And I know you thought we could do this by 2015, but it's kind of the beginning of 2014 and we don't really have a script yet. And so here's the thing. You already have this release date that we would like to erase.
Right. And it's not just a release date. It's a war plan.
That
right?
is correct.
You have Star Wars Episode 7 coming out in 2015. Then you have a spinoff, like perhaps something about Boba Fett. I'm making that up. But a non-trilogy related Star Wars movie, a spinoff like Boba Fett, the movie, that would be coming out in 2016. Then in 2017 is Star Wars Episode 8. And then 2019 is another spinoff. And then 2020 is Star Wars Episode 9. That is their five-year plan, just like the Avengers movies where they had them all mapped out. But the Avengers movies took a while to get off the ground. They moved slowly. They did Iron Man, and then they slowly started to do Friend, and they built up to that first Avengers movie. In this case, they're sort of hitting the ground running and announcing five movies in a row, one year after year after year, and they haven't even made the first one. They haven't even succeeded with the first movie.
Right, and that first movie has to be great.
Well, it doesn't have to be great to be better than The Phantom Menace.
Well, there's the rub, isn't it? I mean, because George Lucas did such a lousy job with those last three films, or the first three prequels.
They're the prequels. Yeah, let's not prequels. Call them. Yeah.
And, you know, they were so mediocre that...
And made so much money
that you could do kind of a half-assed job here and make a better movie, and it will still make a lot of money.
That's right. But nonetheless... I think when they announced this release schedule at the time, you said something like, that's crazy.
I did.
Of course, I always object to it, but
at the time I said, wow, that's like 2 years away. And it took 3 years to make all those movies. So why do they think they can do it now in 2 years just because of digital technology? I can't imagine why. My feeling is slow down, get the movie right, and you will be happier in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, what an insane logic. Well, we're going to announce this date before we're ready to move. We haven't even started filming. We're going to announce a date. And then when you say we need more time, we say, no, we've got the schedule. The schedule depends on the movies actually being good.
That's right. Because, you know, but Bob Iger couldn't actually continue that meeting that he was having with Kathleen Kennedy about a 2016 date because he had to go off to the merchandising meeting so that he could talk about all the Star Wars toys he was going to sell.
In
2015, 2016, 2017, 20, you know, so there's a whole...
Well, there's a lot of moving parts, which is why you don't want to rush it. And you want to make sure you have the 2-3 years that you need to build up to the movie and have all the toys and everything lined up right. That's why you don't want to rush it.
I agree.
You know, how do you know what toys you want when you don't even know what the characters are and what's happening to them?
That's true.
You know, you don't know what planes they're flying. You don't know what ships they're in. You don't know what worlds they're going to. You don't know what creatures they're facing off against. Maybe the villain hasn't even been decided yet. It's just crazy. And we've seen lots of people fiddle with release dates. It's fine to announce stuff in advance as long as you're willing to be flexible and not think it end, you know, it shows the end of the world because you move a movie release date. Well, when you announce them 4 years in advance, it would be bizarre if you didn't change some of the release dates. And in this case, to launch this valuable franchise that they've just gotten a hold of and to rush the first movie in such a ridiculous manner is really stupid.
Well, and 2015 is just packed with tentpole releases. So moving it into 2016 may not be such a bad idea, but of course Disney...
I'm sure there'll be lots of tentpole releases in 2016 as well.
Exactly. And one of them was supposed to be what's the name of that... We just were talking about Johnny Depp and Gore Verbinski, Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, they push Pirates of the Caribbean 9 or whatever they're up to now from 2015 back to 2016 because they didn't have this little thing called a script. And I think I used that joke already, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, but in any case, they didn't have one. And so Jerry Bruckheimer said, we have to push.
Right. Well, it's a big mistake. It doesn't mean the movie can't turn out well, but... why you're really rushing things on something that valuable that you spend all that money on, Why you rushed the first one is beyond me.
Well, you know who's not rushing anywhere?
Who?
Ken Loach. Remember him? He's a filmmaker. He won the old Palme d'Or that we've been talking about back in 2006 for The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Stop mentioning Cannes. Nobody cares about Cannes. I'm just bitter because I haven't been there in 3 years.
Okay, well, you know, he's making this movie called Jimmy Hill, I believe.
And it's his swan song. It's going to be his last feature film. He'll have a documentary or two and some other stuff. But it's his final film that he's making.
Right. Or Jimmy's Hall is what it's called. And
that's right.
And it's going to be his last film because there is no more film. He literally can't shoot film anymore. And he's cutting the film the way he always has on what's called a Steenbeck flatbed editing machine. Now, this is a reel-to-reel, you know, device where you can have, you know, four or six plates. It's all very technical, but it's
like when people picture film editing back in the old days with the physical film and they cut it and splice it together. This is what they're talking about.
Yeah, when they cut a film in the past, they literally cut the film and then scotch taped it back together with, you know, from one shot to the next.
And threw that extra reel of Magnificent Ambersons in the trash.
That's right, because who needs that? but now to keep the picture in sync with the sound, which is on magnetic stock, and the picture is, of course, on a celluloid strip of film that you can see through, they would mark the sprockets, and they would mark the sprockets with these numbers in white so that you would know that 28653 should match up of the sound should match up with 28653 of the picture.
And they need numbering tape to do that.
Right, because it's stamped onto both the film and the magnetic sound tape.
Right, so he's making a movie in a very old-fashioned way. He needs numbering tape, and because nobody makes movies this way anymore, and they sure as heck don't edit them this way anymore, he can't find any numbering tape, or at least he couldn't.
Right, I mean, Kodak might say, hey, look, shoot film, edit digitally. That's done all the time. You shoot the film, you get the 35mm negative, you process that, transfer it to digital, and then you edit, away you go, you never touch film again.
Well, so technology has been his enemy, but in this case, it's also his friend, because he sent out word around the world, hey, we're desperate, we need some numbering tape.
And you know what? Pixar said, guess what? We have some, we have about 19 rolls. Steve Bloom over at Pixar, he edited the Oscar-nominated short Bounden and La Luna over at Pixar, and, well, he had, I guess, 19 rolls lying around, and he sent them off to Loach.
Well, that was awfully helpful. And, you know, that made me think, I mean, this is literally the last year that people will go to a theater in America and probably see a film projected on celluloid. You probably haven't even done that in a while if you're in most major cities or big multiplexes, but very few movies released commercially on a wide release have been shown in celluloid this year. And after 2014, it's not going to happen, right? Basically,
yeah,
it's over.
It's pretty much over already.
I mean, there'll always be some special event or a small art house or something where they'll have a celluloid print. But by and large, you're going to see a new movie in the theater. It's not on celluloid. It's digital.
Yeah, the big problem, of course, is in other territories where they maybe haven't converted to digital projection as fast. So I know Latin America is still in the midst of its conversion. I know certain parts of Asia are also in the midst of a conversion. And
Africa hasn't even started.
Well, no, South Africa has.
South Africa, right. I'm talking about the whole continent as a whole. It's way behind. So hopefully you can skip the building the celluloid multiplexes and jump right to digital, just like they jump right to cell phones.
Right, and that's exactly what's going to happen. They call them new builds, new theaters. You don't put a 35mm projector in there.
Well, I've been worried about drive-in movie theaters because there's a couple hundred of them left in North America. And I think those poor guys, and you said, oh, they're all running out of money. They make very little money to begin with. They're mom and pop operations. They can't afford to switch over to digital. It costs a lot of money, $100,000 per screen. And I thought, well, heck, it's a drive-in. Why not get some of those Latin American prints? Sure, they have subtitles in Spanish on them, but who cares? It's a drive-in. It'll add sort of to the fun of a drive-in. So imagine you could appeal to a Latin audience in America. You still get your cellular print while you're hopefully saving enough money to convert to digital. But until then, at least you got a source of prints that, you know, they still work, right?
Yeah.
So why not?
Yes. I mean, that depends if you've actually made a print for Latin America with Spanish subtitles.
Well, but they're still doing that next year, right? They're not going to be able to shut them out. So
I think that's probably true, although you'd be shocked. I would not be shocked if some studios say, look, it's just too cost prohibitive for us to make special prints for any market, let alone...
Oh, they're not going to rule out a couple hundred million people, are they?
It may not be up to them. Studios always thought it would be up to them, this whole conversion to digital and when they turned off film. They always thought, no, we're in charge here. We don't have to worry.
But events
about...
get out of control at some point.
Right, but the economics were working against them.
They can't get the stock to make enough prints.
Right, and Kodak filed for bankruptcy, and Fuji stopped making the film altogether, and Agfa hasn't made the film in years, so now they have no film stock to actually make the prints, so it's really not up to them.
Well, so what's going to happen? Is it possible that box office could be depressed in Central and South America and perhaps Spain for a while because they don't have the celluloid film to show and they haven't converted over to digital? So they're sort of stuck and not able to show movies in as wide a release as they would like?
I wouldn't worry about Spain, but Latin America, yes, that very well could happen.
So they could be losing money, leaving money on the table for the next year or two while those countries make the conversion.
And I can't tell you the number of heads of distribution that have said to me, tell the people in Latin America and the exhibitors in Latin
it's
America.
It's over. You got to move, baby.
Please, please. I mean, they've all flown down there within the past 6 months. All the heads of distribution have flown down to Latin America, to Brazil and to Argentina and to Colombia to implore some of these exhibitors to please move faster. Because if you don't, you will not be in business.
Not be in business?
Yes.
Well, they won't have the hot new releases.
That is correct.
Right. Well, and Brazil is obviously, that's a huge country.
It's certainly a big deal these days.
But what's the point? It's like 200 million people in Brazil. You don't want to leave that market on the side. So it is a big deal if they can't provide their new movie. If they can't show the next Avengers movie in Brazil, that will be a big deal.
That's right. And it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story this week. You might recall we talked about Twitter Music before, but the demise of Twitter's music app was not greatly exaggerated. In any case, don't let that make you think Twitter and music have broken up. In fact, hashtag music, aka hashtag music, is getting integrated into Twitter's main platform. People love tweeting about TV shows and movies that they've seen, and music isn't far behind, so Twitter will integrate the app into its main feed as one of several topic verticals, which will excite you only if you're, say, a techno geek. In any case, the idea is to link your talking about music with the ability to buy that same music more directly than has ever been possible before. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big confusion. I still don't know what the heck is going on.
What?
I don't understand it. So there's verticals and things. I use Twitter at such like a first grade level. I don't know what the app was. I don't know what a vertical means. I'm on Twitter. And I type, I've just listened to the new Adele album, 25. I'm the first person to get a copy. And it's really, really great. What happens? Do they somehow add a thing, a link, or do I add a link?
Then there's probably a music.twitter.com. Well, I know there is. If you go there, there's a whole website around that. And then it says, oh, look, Michael mentioned it, and so did 50 million other people. Let's put that as the number one trending piece of music on Twitter.
And then people looking for trending music will find Adele's new album, which I haven't heard, of course.
So
it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and it's just mixing and mashing all this data that's coming in through Twitter to say, here's what people are talking about.
That's the vertical that you're talking about.
Right.
And then how do they sell the music? What happens then?
I'm sure they sell it through iTunes or Amazon or
do they automate links to it?
Correct.
Or?
That's absolutely correct.
All right. Okay. So it's not a big deal. We'll have to see how it works, I guess. The big whoop till I see if it's useful and convenient.
Somewhere out there, a teenage girl is crying. That's right, because the Jonas Brothers have officially broken up.
No!
Hold on. I just have to rewrite this teenage girl, Michael. Guilt.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now they're not going to stop being brothers, of course, but they are going to stop touring and recording at quote unquote for now, as one of the brothers announced. Indeed, they couldn't even release a group statement about ending the band.
Ouch.
With Nick and Joe breaking the news via Twitter, you know, that thing that Michael uses on a first grade level. And all three are giving individual statements to People magazine.
That was sad.
Probably
was sad.
At separate times. The writing was on the wall when their current modest tour of 19 cities was canceled before it even began, because these guys, they were fighting over their musical direction. They didn't want to go in one direction. Get it? One direction? Musical direction? Hey, yeah.
Very nice.
Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Oh, that's a big whoop.
Here's the thing. You know what would be a big deal? Going to Thanksgiving dinner with these guys.
Yeah. Very good. But they have sold tens of millions of albums. You know, the one brother has a reality show. Nick Jonas was always called the president. Maybe he'll go into politics. I don't know. But, you know, they've sold a lot of albums, and they're pretty talented, especially Nick. So we'll have to see if they, you know, have a further life. I don't think we're done with them, but they may be as solo artists. Who knows if people will still care, but I'm guessing they will.
I'm filing this next story under, you mean they haven't done that already? Because it's not quite the case of VHS trumping Betamax, but plasma TVs have lost the war against LCD screens, even though their technology was arguably better, especially in the early going. Panasonic was the last major manufacturer invested in plasma, and boy, do we mean invested. They purchased, get this, plasma factories all over, I guess, Asia, and have lost $12 billion on plasma TVs and manufacturing them. Not in total, but in the last 2 years, they lost $12 billion.
Yes. Yeah. Oops. I hate when that happens.
They announced on Halloween that they would be suspending production of all plasma TVs once the units already made were sold. That was it. They're not going to make any more. Plasma has better colors and deeper blacks than LCD screens and never blurred when displaying motion, as in action scenes and, of course, every major sport except possibly golf and that World Series of Poker thing. But LCDs got better. The prices got cheaper, and early concerns about burn-in, this idea that an image on screen too long would, quote-unquote, burn in to the screen itself, and you'd always see it there, they were solved with technical fixes, but still plagued consumers. So, goodbye plasma, hello LCD, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Hello 8K, as I say, it's a big whoop. You know, it's when it finally ends, it's long after everybody else has moved on.
Yeah, I mean, they are much better TVs, but
Are they still much better TVs?
You know what? The difference is becoming more and more negligible, especially with OLED screens. You know, OLED screens are just beautiful, but they're also incredibly expensive. So, you know, plasma, yes, better, richer blacks.
It's the Betamax of its day.
Yeah.
It was better, but it didn't win.
Right.
Speaking of, is there any particular reason why it didn't win?
They were expensive, and there was that burn-in issue. Lots of
very early on, but they solved that quickly, didn't they? And it was always exaggerated, is what this article says. It says, you know, you'd really have to have the TV on for like days and days. Nobody would ever have it on that long with that image for it to actually burn in, but people were freaked out about it.
That's right. Yes. And so because it got that bad rep, then people stopped buying them and they immediately switched over to a cheaper LCD.
Ah, all right.
Cheaper to produce too. So plasma screens, even this late in the flat screen wars, more expensive. And of course, how do you come out with a product that's more expensive that has this, you know, negative
problem? Yeah, negative image. That's crazy.
Yeah. Now, speaking of winning and losing, it's not quite the Booker Prize in terms of commercial impact, but the UK's top critical accolade, the Mercury Prize, gains in stature every year. And this is, I guess, musically, it gains in stature. This time, they've crowned James Blake's folky meets dubstep album Overgrown as tops of the year, beating out such contenders as David Bowie, that hack, Arctic Monkeys, Laura Marling, and Jake Bugg. If it helps his album get higher than its peak position of number 8 in the UK, then the Mercury will prove itself as a spotlight for new talent. A presenter accidentally introduced James Blake as soft rocker James Blunt. Beautiful. Get it? Beautiful. And everyone laughed off the mistake, of course. Currently, Blunt's new album is at number 3, while Blake's album has popped back on at number 23.
On the UK charts.
On the UK charts, and that's thanks to the award. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think it's a prestigious prize. I think they have good taste, a pretty good track record. It should help the album in the UK. It brought it back onto the charts. Hopefully we'll get him even more attention. And it's not quite the force it should be yet. People in America don't really know it, but I think it will help people decide to do stories on him when he tours here. So I think it's a big deal right now, and hopefully it will continue to be a big deal down the road.
You know, we should have probably followed up the plasma story with this one.
All right.
The concept of slow TV is sweeping Norway, and it's on its way to the U.S.
I love this.
See how I slowed things
down?
Yeah,
I saw.
Okay. It's sort of like the Yule log cable channels. Remember those? They sometimes broadcast during the holidays?
Mm-hmm.
Except year-round. The basic idea is a fly-on-the-wall documentary look at a subject combined with hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of live coverage involving a few cameras looking at a particular event and with no commentary or hosts or anything to disturb the slowness of it all. You know what we call that here in the United States? Closed circuit security cameras, actually.
C-SPAN.
Exactly. Norwegians have been captivated by and given big ratings to various events like a 7-hour train ride. I wonder if it's the train ride that I took.
That's awesome, though. Basically, they had a camera, and they showed what people sitting on the train would look at, and they just had a camera out the window, and they had a camera at the front of the train, a camera at the back of the train, and maybe every, like, half an hour. I'm exaggerating. I didn't really know, but they would switch the angle, but that was it. They weren't cutting and creating a thing. They did a live thing, like, on the train, looking out the window, what are people seeing? That's fascinating, and people flocked to their televisions to watch it.
Well, I have taken a 7 to 8 hour train ride through Norway. From Oslo, which is on the eastern end of Norway, you know, southeastern, to Bergen, which is on the southwestern side. And, of course, it goes up through mountains and everything. It is one of the most beautiful train rides you will ever take. And it goes right past where they shot The Empire Strikes Back, all those Hoth scenes. It's beautiful. And I couldn't recommend it enough. If you take the train ride all the way to Bergen just to simply turn around and go back again, it's worth it. But in any case... They were captivated not only by this train ride, but a 6-day cruise, and most recently a 4-hour event called National Knitting Evening. Yes, talk of knitting, the shearing of a sheep, and then knitting and more knitting. They'll even try and break the world record for knitting a sweater after the main broadcast, which will last perhaps another 5 hours or less.
People will turn on their TV at 1 a.m. to see these people furiously knitting.
Well, if they break the 4-hour and 51-minute record for a large man's sweater, it'll be shorter. U.S. rights for this have been purchased. I don't know why there are rights for these things. In any case.
But the concept, they sold it. But yeah, clearly you could just do your own riff on it. But hey, more power to them. They came up with the ideas, and there you go.
Look, if it means a rival for Duck Dynasty, I'm all for it. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. It's knitting on television. Thanks to our reader, Zoe, who is a casting agent, by the way, Sperling, who sent me that story. I love it. She says, hey, people who love knitting, that's my kind of people. But I love the whole concept of slow TV. I think it's hilarious. With 500 cable channels, it's inevitable that it come here. And of course, it will seem silly eventually. But you know what? I've been on a train ride and looked out the window for hours at a time and seen the changing landscape. It's kind of a fascinating idea. So I'm all for it. I can't wait to see that train ride from New York to L.A.
Well, that's going to take about 5 days, but that's another story.
That's true, especially if you're on Amtrak.
In which case, you might be going backwards. But again, somehow we became the transportation show. People have always accused Wynton Marsalis of lecturing others on music and elevating his very traditional spin on jazz history to the one and only truth. Well, now he gets to ensconce that philosophy even further by becoming the head of Juilliard's jazz studies program. Marsalis is already the managing and artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center, so this only further enhances his ability to imprint his take on jazz history for generations to come. And of course, it further enhances Marsalis in general. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, he's obviously a terrific artist. He's done a lot of great music. With all these obligations, though, I think his recording career and touring career is slowing down a bit. I mean, you got the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra is on Broadway now with After Midnight, this sort of show modeled after the Cotton Club. So they're tearing it up on Broadway. So they're there for quite a while now. He's obviously got all these other obligations. If it means it's a cutback on the, creating great new music, that's kind of a shame. But, he's been recording music for, the early 80s. So that's 30 years of recording. So he's got a lot of music in the till. And maybe it's time that he moves more into academia. It's a shame to lose him as an ongoing artist, which I think is what's happening here with all these obligations. But I'm fine with his traditional take on jazz, and it's he makes sense certainly. If you're going to have anybody to be head of your jazz studies program, you'd want Wynton Marsalis.
The reason I put this story in, as someone who used to play trumpet a lot more than I do now, I love the fact that he is starting his position. Earlier than July 1st, which is when the appointment officially begins, because he wants to oversee spring auditions for the 2014 fall class. And I thought to myself, Wow. As a trumpet player, could you imagine auditioning for Wynton Marsalis?
What's the... Like, if you're going to sing, it'd be okay, but playing the trumpet would be rough.
You may as well just, like, throw the horn aside and go, forget it.
I imagine if you had any siblings, they probably had to hear you play one song over and over and over again in high school. I had to hear my brother play Billy, Don't Be a Hero over and over and over again on the trumpet. So whenever I want to make fun of him, I just start to play Billy, Don't Be a Hero, a schlocky 70s pop song. But there you go. What was your song? What did you do in the band? What was your big solo?
Fly Me to the Moon.
That sort of thing?
Yeah,
very
swing.
Nice. Very nice. Well, you know, that's not the only big classical and high arts music that we have. The New York City Opera, of course, is dead. But La Scala is also reeling.
I don't get this. What is going on with opera?
Yeah, they lost their managing director a few weeks ago, and now the artistic director and conductor Daniel Barenboim, I hope I'm saying his name right, is walking away 2 years before his contract ends. So basically all the top people at La Scala have just walked out the door.
Well, Daniel Barenboim, and yes, you did say his name correctly, he is, you know, a world-renowned musical conductor and a musical director, and he's, you know, been featured on numerous recordings of opera. But I'm sure once the artistic director left to go off to the Paris Opera, he said, that's it. I'm out. I'm not going to stick around here. This is, you know, I'm on a sinking ship.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, people can leave and new people can come in. It can be a smooth transition, or he could influence who the new managing director was and work well with them and come up with new ideas. So, I mean, the fact that one guy left doesn't mean he had to leave.
No.
Or said, oh, it's a nightmare. Could have been an opportunity for him to extend his influence at La Scala. But whatever's going on there, it ain't good. And he's walking out the door, too. So now they're really, really, you know, falling apart because, you know, this is opera. And, you know, they don't do things next month. They don't plan 6 months in advance. They're kind of like Hollywood, but they stick to their schedule. They know what they're doing for the next 5 years. And singers have committed to shows that are going to be done in like 2017, 2018 at La Scala. You know, I mean, that's how far in advance they map this stuff out.
Yeah,
so
I wanted to play.
When he says he's walking away now and people thought he'd be there for the next 2 years at least, there are people who expected to work with him, you know, in 2014 and 2015 and 2016, who suddenly find out he's not there. Now they may try to get out of their contract or they're going to be very unhappy. You know, it's a real mess.
That is true. And I tried to find a story in Opera News, the big opera magazine, to place in our show notes here for this particular story, and to show you how long lead opera is. Like, they don't even have a breaking news section.
Yeah.
Like, they have, you know, next year's news about next year's schedule. I'm like,
whoa. In 2015. Yeah, exactly. That's opera for you. Well, so somebody who knows the inside scoop on opera, who knows sort of the inside baseball, what's going on there, could perhaps fill us in as to why La Scala is suddenly in turmoil.
Oh, I see. You're trying to move us along into inside baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you, our listeners. And this week, our stories will most certainly affect you, because if you like baseball or football or any game that's being played in your hometown, but you can't watch it on television because the home team's hasn't sold out, well, the FCC, at least here in the United States, may end blackouts for such games.
Okay, now, so you're going to carry the water. We got three or four stories. We talk about the blackout rules. We talk about Time Warner Cable and their battle with CBS. We're going to talk about Disney and Dish fighting over broadcast fees and the future of TV. And we got Netflix and a little bit of info on that. So you're going to carry the water on this. So tell me, Sperling, I'm in New York, and I watch the Yankee games on TV all the time. I don't recall the last time a game was blacked out, and they certainly haven't sold out every game.
Yeah, no way. Well, it depends on the league. So the baseball almost never gets blacked out. So let's just throw baseball aside.
But football does.
But it's mostly football. When a big giant football game isn't sold out, they'll black it out in that particular
and so
market.
The idea was in the old days, hey, they don't want to hurt attendance, so we'll black out the game to make sure that if you live in that little area, you can't assume, oh, I can watch it on TV, because, hey, if it's not sold out, guess what? It won't be on TV. That was the idea, to protect attendance at the game.
Correct. And now the acting head of the FCC, Chairwoman Mignon Clyburn, has said, quote, changes in the marketplace have raised questions about whether these rules are still in the public interest, particularly at a time when high ticket prices and the economy make it difficult for many sports fans to attend games. Let me translate. Hey, NFL, you have a monopoly, a legalized monopoly, and the tickets to your games are exceedingly expensive now because you're trying to pay off all these big stadiums that frankly, you charge the taxpayers for anyway. So we're actually going to stop blacking out your games.
Well, I wish it was a question of them righteously, you know, stomping out. But I don't think the football teams care anymore. They used to make all their money on attendance, but now TV money dwarfs what they make with fans at the game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the teams are like, heck, stay home.
Yeah, what do they care? They don't care if the stadium's empty. You look at Yankee Stadium, that place is half empty all last season, and they were in first place for the first half, and they have to watch their camera angles to make sure they don't show empty seats. They keep the camera angles tight in on the players, because if they pull back or follow a ball sometimes, they're going to show you that all those seats near the dugout are literally empty. And so they have to worry about that because it looks bad, but they don't care financially because they make all their money on TV. So it's sort of a changing with the times and saying, yeah, you know what? They don't really care about the attendance anymore so much.
Well, now, speaking of attendance and blackouts, okay, let's move on to Time Warner Cable. You might recall us talking ad nauseum about this blackout that happened in Dallas and New York and LA. CBS, they blacked out CBS. They couldn't come to a retransmission consent agreement. Back in August, the entire month of August, CBS could not be found on Time Warner Cable channels in those cities. Well, guess what? Now Time Warner Cable is saying, hey, let's announce our results, our financial results for the third quarter or fourth quarter, whatever quarter it is that they're in. And oh, by the way, we also lost 306,000 video subscribers, mostly due to the fact that we were in this dispute with CBS.
Now, that seems like a lot, but I wonder, what's their churn? How many did they gain? Is that the total loss, including people gained and lost? Or is, you know, I couldn't get good numbers here. And I also didn't get a good comparison of how many they lost the quarter of the year before. You know, I found the article a little lacking, but it sounds like a lot of people to be lost because it's a big pain in the neck to switch your cable provider.
That's right. And they've been losing, viewers to and subscribers to satellite companies and phone companies that are now offering cable. Some are just cutting subscribers are cutting the cord entirely. This is not news that there are fewer cable subscribers. It's been going down, not to this extent, not, you know, all at once like this.
Well, did they put a happy face on it? Did they say this was bad? Did they have an explanation for it? Did they try to downplay it? What was happening for them?
Well, they said, look, a profit was $532 million, which is a drop of 34% from the same period a year ago. But revenue increased 2.9% to $5.5 billion, which unfortunately was below expectations. There was nothing you could do to spin this properly.
So that's a lot of people that they lost in the fight. That's the spin that we're getting from the LA Times, and they're not countering
that. And from numerous sources. But here's the real rub, okay? Uh-huh. Basically, everybody, all the cable operators, the MSOs, the multi-channel service operators, they wanted
Time Warner Cable, Cablevision, those people.
Right. They wanted Time Warner Cable to go to war with CBS because they wanted
to win. And win.
And
they did
win.
Go to war, but they lost.
Yeah, exactly. And they lost big time here. And so now when, I don't know, ABC or NBC or whoever owns those particular networks comes to Dish or Cablevision or Liberty or any other MSO and says, hey, we want to up the fees.
They're over a barrel. They can't say screw
exactly,
you because they know they're going to lose a lot of people.
Exactly. So what's going
like
to happen?
Just like I said, I don't care what CBS is asking for you. I'm paying $160 a month, Time Warner, and I want my CBS.
That's right.
So what does this mean? They can't ask for the moon every month and, you know, expect everyone to make money. Does it mean Time Warner's going to cut their profits more because of all these big fees?
No, they're just going to pass it along to, say, you and me.
Of course. So we can look forward to even bigger cable bills down the road.
That's right. And even less product, because let's move over to Dish. Dish is a satellite provider, kind of like Time Warner is a cable provider. Time Warner Cable is a cable provider. I always have to, you know, Time
it's
Warner.
It's not Time Warner. It's
That's
Time
right.
Warner Cable. Different company.
Well, Dish and Disney have been in this argument over, guess what, broadcast fees. But of course, Disney has grouped all of its networks together. So you have the Disney Channel, you have ESPN, you have ABC.
ABC, big, big channels.
Yeah, and that's something that the MSOs, the video providers, can't do. Time Warner Cable can't work with Cablevision, can't work with Comcast to go up against ABC or CBS and say, hey, we're going to negotiate together here. And yet
right.
all of these networks can. So,
well, no, it's just one network. It's just one network that owns multiple channels.
Right, no.
ABC cannot collude with CBS and NBC. They can control their own channels and decide what they want to ask for their own channels. So let's not confuse it.
Well,
those
it's
are
different
separate
networks,
companies.
One broadcaster, but yes.
Right, one company with multiple channels.
Right.
Right. They're allowed to say what they want to do with their own channels. They cannot, you know, collaborate with CBS and NBC.
Yes, however, with ABC, they don't own all of those channels, those networks in each
They don't own ESPN? Of course they do.
No, they don't own the local affiliates, and yet they can team up with those local affiliates to negotiate those rights. It gets complicated. But here's the rub for this particular story.
What are they fighting over?
Disney and Dish, believe it or not, they've reached a consent agreement monetarily. They have agreed that Dish will pay billions of dollars over X number of years to rebroadcast all of these this programming from Disney. Here's what they is holding up the big announcement of that the contract
signing
is
signing the contract. Yeah.
The fact that they haven't agreed to digital rights.
So Dish wants to say, hey, we want to do the hopper. We want to do that thing where you can record all of prime time at one full sweep and then skip over ads. They want to allow people to watch things on their laptop, on their tablet. Should they have to be in their home? They want to sort of create TV everywhere, which is sort of the catchphrase. Say, hey, people pay us couple hundred dollars a month for our programming. We want them to be able to access it, not just physically standing in front of their TV, but anywhere they are.
Right. Now let's stop for a moment, because forget about the hopper for just a second.
Okay. Because really, that's a very particular DVR type issue.
Right. Let's just look at Dish and what they're asking. They're saying, no. We want ESPN, all that stuff, Disney TV and ABC, and we want to be able to broadcast it via satellite into the home and the big TV screen and give it to our subscribers. Also, we'd like to, as you say, Michael, have TV everywhere. If they're a paying subscriber to us, we want to allow those same subscribers to watch it on their laptop. We'll create a little app for them, and they can watch it on their laptop or on their tablets.
Because they're paying for it.
It's their content. They've paid me for it already as Dish. They paid us for it, and we're paying you. So technically, they've paid for the content. What Disney is saying is, oh, no. They've paid for the content in one form on television. Right. They have not paid for the content on a tablet. They have not paid for the content on a laptop.
Which is outrageous, because they just want to charge you again to watch it
the very same content.
Right.
That's right.
Because I'm a subscriber to the Yes Network. I get on my cable provider. But then if I want to watch the Yes Network they'll let me watch it in New York State on another laptop if I pay an extra fee. And I'm like, excuse me, I'm already paying money.
But that's a whole Major League Baseball issue as well. So
No. It's separate. This is Yes Network trying to charge me extra money for accessing the same thing in a different way. It's not about baseball. This is Yes. Because baseball has their own plan that they sell access to Major League Baseball all over the country, except for your local team, the one you really want to watch, and that's another charge that they do. But I'm not asking to get access to every game ever made. I'm asking access to the game I pay for to watch on my local cable channel, and the idea that I can't call it up on my tablet when I'm an hour away or at work is stupid.
Now let's bring the hopper back in. The hopper is basically TiVo, okay? It's
right.
A digital video recorder that has a little button that says skip over all these commercials, because of course there are broadcast tags and commercial tags that go out with the signal that say this is a commercial, this is an advertisement, and so it can just blip.
Makes it even easier to skip over ads. You don't even have to fast forward through them or skip minute by minute. You just press one button.
That is correct. And so what Disney is saying is, we want you to kill that product. We don't want that product at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So
fair enough. They say, hey, that's where we make a lot of revenue.
Right.
You want to broadcast our shows without the ads, which is the only reason we can afford to show the shows in the first place.
Right. And of course, Dish is saying, hey, so what you're saying is you'd like us to stop taking money out of your pocket, or what you could perceive to be money out of your pocket? That's interesting how you think we're affecting your business, and how you're trying to sell us something that, really is only good in one venue, but not another, i.e., on television. But
so
not...
Disney has all the power here, is what you're going to tell me.
Oh,
because
yeah, they
Disney has
have the power.
ABC and ESPN and the Disney Channel and the Dish Network, as we've learned with Time Warner. If they're going to wrangle with them, if they're going to dump ESPN and ABC and Disney, well, then suddenly they're going to have very unhappy subscribers.
That's right. I mean, it is definitely time for the government to step in. And please don't ask me what they should do, because I'm not going to, we're already running long and there's no way I could solve this problem right now. But
and there's not enough competition for the cable providers anyway. I mean, they're no lovable poor creatures.
No,
it's crazy that Time Warner Cable has essentially a monopoly in New York City, but it's very, very hard for someone else to get in here. So it's crazy. They're both devils and they're both horrible, and people hate their cable provider, and they rightly hate what all the networks are stopping them from watching TV. They want to watch it. So a curse on both their houses.
That's true. A plague, I thought it would be, but...
A plague, a pox, a curse, you name it. I could do it all.
We can say all that on a podcast, right? Plague, pox.
Sure.
Okay, just
checking. What about Netflix?
Okay, so
that's
now...
That's our last little story. I love this.
Okay, so here's the thing. So, of course, Disney wants to sell all of its content to Hulu and Amazon, and of course, Netflix. They want to be able to sell it twice. Once to Dish, once
and
to Time Warner.
And they can. People pay for Netflix.
That's right. And so they're saying, no, we can't give you... the content Dish, because if we give it to you for digital, then we can't sell it to Netflix or Amazon.
But so, they're forgetting that somebody may not own Dish and they're happy to pay for Netflix, or they may not have a cable at all.
Right.
So they're seeing that no one's going to pay twice for the same thing.
Precisely.
But it's just stupid. It's just very narrow. Like, they're seeing it as competition, but it's not. If I'm paying for Dish, I should be able to access it wherever. I don't want to pay for Dish and for access on my phone and for access on my tablet and for access on my laptop. That's crazy.
So what they want to do, what I love is that Disney is saying, look, we want you to stop providing this Hopper thing that allows people to skip all the commercials that we make money on. Mm-hmm. And we're going to keep the digital rights for ourselves, and we're going to sell them to Netflix where people don't have to watch commercials.
Right, and they should sell it to Netflix and elsewhere, because that's fine. Make it available at all these different places.
And if you're Dish, why would you say, oh, yeah, no. Let's kill one of our strategic a product that gives us a strategic advantage.
Right, but what's going to happen? They're both fighting. They both have, Netflix. Dish cannot give up ABC, and ABC doesn't want to give them the rights to they're greedy and don't want to let them offer TV everywhere so that subscribers to Dish can get a valuable service from that company.
Well, we were talking about Netflix.
Yeah, what are they doing?
Well, they are actually beginning to provide Ultra HD 4K videos, and they're beginning to add them to their catalog. They've added 7 titles already, and they hope...
Out of the million that they have.
Well, but now these 7 titles are all, get this, they're kind of like test material. Mm-hmm. So the first one is like, I think it's basically just, an example of 4K at 24 frames per second. And it just shows bicycles at 24 frames per second. And it's
sure,
like,
they're just testing it out on their own. It's not something that they expect people to watch.
Correct. Yeah. Now, the issues become, of course, what are the bandwidth requirements into the home that you would need?
I don't know what that means.
You know, so you have 4K right now. You've got 1080 coming into your house. OK, and you've got a straw. Well, if you try and shove more liquid through that same straw,
and people already complain that Netflix takes up 30% during primetime hours of streaming video.
Exactly.
And yet another reason why caps will kill, why they're fighting against caps and people who provide internet service like Time Warner Cable want to have a cap so they can charge you extra when Netflix starts streaming and all that stuff and competing with their own cable provider, the cable programming that they provide.
That's absolutely correct.
So everybody's fighting with everybody.
Well, Netflix says, hopefully by the end of next year, 2014, we will have a lot more Ultra HD 4K content. So will there be a call for 4K televisions? You better believe it.
That goes against what we said last week.
No, I said that there would be, but the problem is you need the content. And that as screens get bigger, you're going to need 4K.
I'm not buying a 4K. I'll buy an 8K. Why would I buy a 4K?
Oh, I see what you're saying. The reason that you might buy a 4K is because, frankly, 8K may be just too far off. It may be 12, 14, 15 years off.
Well, as long as it's backward compatible, as long as it's not wildly expensive, because they can't think I'm going to spend an extra, $3,000 for the pleasure of 4K. If it's just I need a new TV and that's the best one available and it's backward compatible and there's some new programming, that's okay.
Well, like everything, it will be expensive at first and then prices will begin to drop as more manufacturers come into the market with 4K televisions.
But so there's no benefit to it unless you have a 4K screen?
There's no benefit to watching. No, there is no benefit.
What if you watch it on your laptop? That screen's different, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and no real benefit there. Well, I know that a lot of this TV stuff is very U.S.-centric, I don't necessarily know what's done in every single region around the world and whether these issues crop up, retransmission, etc., in other areas of the world, though I would love to know. And I know we have a lot of listeners out there who listen to us and say, well, gee, all that FCC stuff, that doesn't really mean anything to us because I live in, whether it's the United Kingdom or Australia or Japan.
Or Portugal, or who knows?
Yeah, but you know what? email us. Let us know how this is done in your territory. We would love to know. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even call us and tell us. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts for free. We can be found there. Of course, you can rate and review the show on any of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to contact us, ways to follow us. We can be found on Twitter, where our handle is showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, where you can like us. Our page is, just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and it'll be there. All of this information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. This week, it's going to be
castingagentsrock.com.
Wow. Okay. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.